It's the Wonky Show. The Migration Advisory Committee has had its say on what government should do about the graduate route, and we're reviewing the fallout. Meanwhile, OFS has a huge and troubling new report into the financial health of universities. It's all coming up.
So there is a sort of, if not a growth model, a different kind of growth model. On the other hand, if I'm sat at a university reading this, I would probably think, well, yes, I would do those things if it was that easy to do.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Beach, and joining me to run down the week in higher education policy are three fantastic guests as always. In Camberwell, it's Eve Alcock, Director of Public Affairs at QAA. Eve, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week was watching Ella Toon score the most brilliant goal at the SA Cup final, Women's FA Cup final on Sunday, if that counts as this week still.
Just about. And in Westminster, it's Jonathan Simons, partner and head of education at Public First. Jonathan, your highlight of the week, please.
Morning, Mark. Morning, everyone. My highlight of the week is my daughter is currently halfway through her year six residential. So she's off doing all manner of activities. And we heard from her last night and she's having a wonderful time. So that has pleased and reassured me.
Lovely. And in Blythe, it's James Coe, Wonky's associate editor. James, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi Mark, it's been a quiet week, so my highlight has been starting Tim Shipman's No Way Out and just finding a quiet corner to read in and relax a little bit.
Very good. Now, we start the week with the Mac review. James, walk us through it, please.
Yes, Mark, it's the return of the Mac, the Big Mac. It's the most, I'd say the biggest news story this week. So, in March, James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, commissioned the Migration Advisory Committee, the Mac, to carry out a rapid review of the graduate route. For listeners who are less familiar with the graduate route, it allows students to stay in the UK for 2 years in the case of undergraduates, or 3 years for PhD graduates. The concern of the Home Secretary and the reason he commissioned the review was that he was concerned that international students were becoming students to then take advantage of the graduate route. He was concerned that there were abuses in the system, that it was a route to immigration rather than a route to study. The Migration Advisory Committee has come back and said, in quote, there is no evidence of significant abuse. This has been met with relief across the sector. Interestingly, the data, while it is exceptionally patchy, also demonstrated that graduate route switchers are moving into graduate level jobs at the end of their visa in roughly the same proportions as domestic graduates. It is seen as good news for the sector, but the debate of the future of the route is certainly not over.
Right, so Jonathan, the findings obviously are kind of broadly in line with what the sector would have wanted, hoped for following this process, but it's not gone down brilliantly in every single quarter, has it?
No, there's been a remarkable amount of bad grace around it from politicians. So indeed, as I wrote on Wonky earlier this week about it, there's been a lot of pushing, particularly from the CPS, the Centre for Policy Studies, and for Onward, who've written a lot about how the Mac should have taken action on the graduate route, and in fact, how the graduate route should have been entirely abolished. And I think having commissioned the review, having set the terms of reference, having set the timetable, and having essentially given the Mac as clear a steer as possible to look at all of those concerns, the Mac has come back in a pretty weighty report and said, not much to see here, Gov. And as opposed to saying, okay, fair enough, people are now, calling foul, shouting at the ref, saying that it's a whitewash. You know, this is pretty poor faith acting. You know, the Mac was asked a series of questions, has come back and actually, I think, done a remarkably good job. I mean, yes, the data is patchy, but frankly, I thought the data was going to be non-existent given what the Mac was being asked to do and the timescale. So I think they've done a remarkably good job. And, you know, it doesn't give you the answer you want, so you cry foul. It's not great politics.
Jonathan, can I just on that, I don't understand the politics of this. So it seems like afterwards you don't get the result you want, so say, okay, well, it wasn't very good. But presumably this also undermines any future argument where actually a report like this agrees with what the people on that argument want anyway. I don't understand where it's going.
Well, I mean, where it's going is essentially it allows either the government or future Conservative oppositions or indeed future Conservative think tanks to not use it as a thoughtful piece of evidence against their case. If you frankly say that you can't count it, then you can continue to make your argument. And the fact that somebody else has thought about this more thoroughly than you and disagrees with you if you're sort of preemptively dismissing them, then it just means that you can't use this as an argument. So it is, I'm afraid, though, it is a trajectory towards a group of people talking to themselves rather than actually thoughtfully engaging in policy.
But we're way past kind of evidence on this issue, aren't we? I mean, it kind of those people who believe what they believe don't want international students to come to the UK or want them to fall significantly no matter the evidence for negative effects of doing so, right? So it's no piece of evidence is going to change their mind about that. I mean, Eve, the sector has been kind of across the airwaves on this in the run up and during the release. How would you rate that interaction?
So, I mean, I've been quite proud of the sector, to be honest, from everything it's kind of thrown at this. But, you know, as we were just saying, the reality is that the sector is fighting this on facts and figures, and the government is fighting it on sort of ideology and politics. And you can't really win if you're playing different games. I think one of the things that I would really recommend listeners do, actually, is have a scroll through Twitter, if you can bear it, or X, I suppose, and go on either press coverage of this MAC review or any of the sort of replies to GB News clips. And I think it's actually really important to do that because you start to see the other echo chamber that exists in equal force against the kind of groundswell that the sector is trying to push forward here. I think some of the most effective stuff I've seen the sector do on this, actually, has been mobilising the voice of big business. So giants like Siemens and others came out, I think it was late last night, actually, expressing concern on this. And it's that kind of thing that we need to be playing much more because it starts to push at the boundary of the echo chamber that we exist in.
Yeah, so those big woke corporates and their woke agendas. I thought Vivian Stern was she pulled a bit of a short straw up against Jacob Rees-Mogg, but held her own. Here's a clip.
It's a slam dunk good thing for Britain that we have such strong relationships with countries all around the world because so many people come and study here.
Oh, that's brilliant. And Lee Kuan Yew was educated at Cambridge and it helped our relationship with Singapore for generations. But these many hundreds of thousands who are coming in aren't all Lee Kuan Yews, are they?
I mean, come on though, damehood for Vivian here. I think, you know, this is really interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, just to be sort of semi-serious about this for a second, the default response oftentimes, particularly from Universities UK, is that you have to take a sort of fairly conciliatory, lowest common denominator approach. They have lots and lots of members across all sorts of different tariffs, different positions, different sizes. And oftentimes it's quite hard for them to be bullish and combative. And what I've really noticed in the run-up to and post-MAC is that actually, you know, not just on media, but on social media as well, she's really come out swinging on this. And I think that is exactly what Universities UK is for. I think she's done it in a really kind of politely assertive way. I think fair play to her going on GB News and actually going toe-to-toe. It's really, really impressive. And I hope people are very, very pleased with what UK have done for them.
I mean, I just on that, I mean, I thought she was brilliant, but Jacob Rees-Mogg's comments about Lee Kuan Yew, he went to Cambridge in 1947. You know, this sort of veneration.
Yeah, but that's modern. That's modern times for Jacob Rees-Mogg. That's like, I mean, last week.
It's this veneration of nostalgia that somehow you can turn back the world and actually part of the student immigration debate is about a different kind of Britain. And, you know, you stop student immigration, it's part of this message about sort of, you know, the culture wars more generally. But I think there's two fundamental problems with it. Our sort of wider strategies, our economic ambitions, rely on our international student imports and our exports for that matter. But secondly, there just isn't a world where we are going to go back to a type of sort of nation state and that existed when Lee Kuan Yew was at Cambridge in the 50s. It is absolutely nonsense. I think, yeah, Vivian was superb.
It's difficult for Labour because they don't want to, pre-election, be in a position where they can be painted as being soft on migration. And it's on the pledge card, of course, that Keir Starmer's launching this morning. You know, this launch of Border Force or Snooper Force, or I can never remember which one is in the thick of it and which one is actually in real life. But you know, they are very aware that it's traditionally been a weakness of Labour. They're very aware that a lot of the people they need to win over in the election are people for whom controlling migration is a very, very important issue. So they are treading carefully. But I do think that actually, you know, a lot of this now depends on the government response, which is probably going to come next week. And we may talk about that in a little bit. But a lot of what Labour will say will depend on the government response. And my sense is that Labour will almost certainly want to see minimal change happen to this. And if they get into office post-election, it will continue as it has been.
It is a real bind, though, isn't it, Eve? Because if Labour do want to reduce migration and is going to election, you know, promising that, I mean, this is kind of one of the low hanging fruits, isn't it, in terms of the levers you can pull?
Yeah, certainly. And I suppose the danger is that they just have bigger fish to fry or other priorities that take precedent than sort of reversing whatever damage might be done. I think that there's also, obviously, the sector will be worried about what Labour will or won't do should they get elected at the next election. But there's also a sort of, we need to not be caught on the back foot here of whatever the next sort of MAC review moment is between now and the next general election. And we need to be thinking about how ahead of time, how we make sure that we're playing on the same, we're sort of playing the same game as the government, on the same terms as the government, and how we illuminate and engage with some of those arguments early. Because there will be other quote-unquote MAC review moments between now and the general election. And I think now is also a moment, whilst everything else is going on, to make sure that we're ahead of the game on that too.
I do think that's a really important point because, you know, there were some things that the MAC review found which were not great for the sector. So particularly around agents, obviously. And, you know, there's been some pretty shoddy practice on agents, which the sector, you know, having been stung by the Sunday Times, is now sort of slightly retrospectively trying to fix. But the MAC is telling them to go further, and I'm pretty sure government will move further on that. There's also, you know, it is undeniably true that the growth of visas has not all been to Cambridge and Russell Group. It has been largely around the lower tariff universities. And there is something in that. And, you know, if we use the quality word, and Eve will in a minute shout, I need to define how I use quality. But it is worth thinking that in normal world, people do want to see high quality, quote unquote, students and high quality, quote unquote, universities. And, you know, as much as it is important correctly to sort of push back on brightest and best and say, well, you know, you can't just stick with that. You can't define it. It's not just Yi Kuan Lu at Cambridge. I do think, precisely to Eve's point, that the sector does need to get ahead of it, because even under a Labour government, something will happen in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or 5 years' time when this issue will come back around again, and we need to be able to tell a good story on it.
I think the messages we have seen by the Home Secretary in the last few weeks of the steps we're taking already are helping to ease immigration numbers, we're doing lots and lots of other measures in and around the uses of visas that relate to students and graduates. I think what this is setting up is, I hope, for minimal intervention. I think the government will have to be seen to do something, but my sense is this is very much a live debate between the wing of the Conservative Party, which is ignore the MAC, we want evidence-led policy, policy-led evidence, and the wing of the party, which, yeah, I wish, the wing of the party, which is doing the policy-led evidence, and then the wing of the party, which is we need students as an economic contributor. I don't think the MAC will settle that debate, but I think the government's going to have to do something. So I would suspect something, but not a huge intervention, if I had to put a bet on it now.
I mean, they'll want to find an elegant climb down. I mean, I feel, well, can I recall two versions of this? Because I may now still be proven at the last minute.
All right, Boris Johnson, go on.
Let me be slightly optimistic here and swing to the end of the spectrum, because one of the things I have been saying for a number of weeks since the MAC review was launched was that I suspected it might have ended like this. I suspected that given the terms of reference, given the speed with which it did it, that the MAC would not give the Home Office the lever it wanted in order to make change. And what will be happening right now in Whitehall is a continuation of the argument that happens every time we talk about migration, where Number 10 and the Home Office line up on one side, and the Treasury and the Department for Education and the Department for Business and Trade line up on the other side. And absent a smoking gun from the MAC, absent a way in which the MAC can knife student immigrations, you see what I did there? I think that we are going to end up in a world where, you know, Number 10 will not be able to push something through this side of an election. It will almost certainly become a Conservative Party manifesto commitment, but I think it is now, I would say, very, very likely that the graduate route will remain unchanged.
Oh, I wish I had your confidence, Jonathan. The two.
Well, hold on. I'm going to record my pessimistic one in a second. Hold on.
Go on.
No, go on, James. Go on.
So there's two things that make me nervous. So we know there is a release next week on visa figures, And I think depending what that looks like, it will put some pressure on the idea to do something. I think the political climb down is hard because of the salience that the Conservative Party have put into immigration more generally as that key election issue. And I think it would be difficult for them to go into an election to say, we said we're going to reduce immigration, we have a lever to do it, and we are going to choose not to because of a recommendation of the committee that the public have never heard of. I think it's tough, but I'm really, really hoping you're right.
Well, let's come back. Let's come back in a few weeks and see which one is which kind of you've got proven right.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hey there. I'm Beth Elder, president at Queen's Student Union. This week on Monkey, I've been blogging about the Russell Group Student Union Manifesto. We're on a mission to break down barriers imposed by soaring student costs because it's time for comprehensive student maintenance support that matches the real living wage, alongside fair access to free childcare. And let's not forget our future healthcare professionals because they need better funding too. Creating a thriving learning environment means tackling the housing crisis head on. We need more affordable options and legal protections to ensure students have a safe place to call home. But our concerns aren't limited to domestic issues. We're giving the government a gentle nudge, okay, maybe more of a shove, for a revamped visa system to welcome international students with open arms. They're an integral part of our community and we need to make them feel valued. Let's face it, the future of UK higher education is at a crossroads. We're overly reliant on international student fees and it's time for a comprehensive review of the sector. We want a system that works for everyone involved. So, what's next? Well, we want to collaborate with policymakers and the sector to make real change happen. So please read our manifesto, reach out, and let's shape a brighter future together.
My name is Neil Oakley and I'm Communities Manager here at The Brilliant Club. And in this week's blog, me and my colleagues Charlotte Hallahan and Asha Noor explain how engagement with the community can help a university develop an admissions policy that takes account of context. In October last year, a Cardiff parent group called Cardiff Parent Power successfully campaigned for Cardiff University to improve how it shares information on how students can apply for contextual admissions. Contextual admissions policies are policies designed to ensure that the background of a university applicant and any barriers they face are considered as part of the admissions process. We suggest that contextual admissions are an important tool for ensuring equality of access, but universities should be thinking about how they can make the most of their policies, how they can make them accessible, and how they can use them to build trust in their local communities. Check out this week's blog to learn more.
And elsewhere on the site this week, we continue to look at election manifestos through history and what they have to say about higher education.
Hi, I'm Adam Matthews, Senior Research Fellow at the University of Birmingham. Debbie McVitie and I are continuing our analysis of general election manifesto texts from 1945 to 2019. This week I have immersed myself in the 1960s to take a deep dive into what the three biggest political parties were saying about higher education in the general election manifesto texts of 1964 and 1966. And there's a bit of pop culture, politics and sport thrown in too. Just two general elections in the 1960s and both were won by Labour, led on both occasions by Harold Wilson. The 1960s was the decade of the Robbins Report, which famously stated that courses of higher education should be available for all of those who are qualified by ability and attainment to pursue them and who wish to do so. The election manifestos of the 1960s followed the lead of the Robbins Report, with cross-party consensus on more universities and more students. A key driver of much of this growth in the manifesto texts is to train and educate teachers to meet the demand of an increasing population and the 1944 Butler Act, which made secondary schooling universal and free for the first time. Universities also were described as key to science and technology development on a global stage. As an Open University graduate myself, I must make reference to a key education innovation of the 1960s, the establishment of what was originally called the University of the Air. The 1966 Labour Manifesto text said that by taking advantage of TV and radio technology, the new distance learning institution, to be later called the Open University, would bring equality of opportunity to obtaining a degree, as well as study for general knowledge and interest. You can read my article on the site.
Now, hot off the press, the Office of Students has landed with its financial sustainability report for universities. Eve, please walk us through it best you can.
Yes. So from a quick glance over the last sort of 10 minutes, I mean, as expected, probably the headlines do look pretty bleak. They outline five key risks to the sort of funding situation. That's the continuing decline in real terms funding from inflation, a recent reduction in applications across the board, but especially from international students, reliance on international fee income, pressures around the investment needed both for net zero and estates maintenance, and then the sort of general bite of the cost of living as well. And I think it's also worth flagging in the quote from the CEO of OFS, Susan Lapworth, it says, "Our modelling suggests that no growth across the sector could leave nearly two-thirds of institutions in deficit by 2026-27, with 40% facing low liquidity at year end."
Right, so pretty much no good news, right? Except for the 60% not in deficit.
I wouldn't say so, Mark. I wouldn't say it's bad news everywhere. And, you know, without quoting another podcast, I think reasons to be cheerful. There's two things here, right? So number one is there is evidence that institutions are taking action to offset the financial difficulties they're facing. We know about the high-profile redundancy schemes we've seen throughout the sector. But the report also notes that there is less effectiveness in a wait-and-see approach, i.e. hoping something will come along. I think the second is that while the OFS suggests that universities are too optimistic about recovering their finances through recruitment and recruitment of more international students, the sort of fundamentals of the UK's universities being a good thing and a growth sector and still attractive will be true by 26-27, the point at which universities expect their finances to start to recover.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things that they do show is that this current year, the 23-24 year, is the peak, according to the OFS modelling, of universities recording deficits. So there's 108 universities recorded deficits for the 23-24 academic year. That is projected to decline to 74, then 57, then 41. So by 26-27, even not assuming any kind of increase in funding in any way, we've got more than a sort of 60% decline of number of universities forecasting deficits. So although, you know, the headline warning from Susan is pretty bleak, the caveat in there is important, which is absent any significant changes. And as we know, universities aren't making changes.
But the way that is going to happen is by significant change to universities, or in other words, quite drastic cuts. Because to climb out of this, if the sector is successful in rebalancing that way, then we are talking about a bit of a it's quite a serious retraction.
Although,
the scale of the sector.
In their insight brief, the Office for Students gives some sort of, you know, handy hints and tips of things universities might do in order to think about their financial position. And they talk about rethinking the business model, rebalancing resources spent on teaching and research, phasing out some courses, very difficult, seeking to recruit different students to different types of courses, etc., etc. So there is a sort of, if not a growth model, a different kind of growth model. On the other hand, if I'm sat at a university reading this, I would probably think, well, yes, I would do those things if it was that easy to do.
There's not a university in land that hasn't gone through all of those options in detail and decided, you know, which combination of what to do to try and climb out of this.
I think the problem is that no matter which way you cut it, the sort of major income stream for universities, or the major growing income stream for universities, is international students. Like, it's not going to be degree apprenticeships, right? It's not going to be sort of level 3, 4, 5 qualifications. It is international students predominantly.
Yeah. And, you know, as long as I've been working in higher education, Jonathan, and probably the same with you, people are predicting, you know, we're this close to a, you know, university failing, or a major traditional university failing and, you know, exiting the market. Does this point to us actually getting closer to that, or is that still just so politically unpalatable that despite eye-watering deficits, you know, means will be found to stop total failure?
Well, I think those are two different questions, aren't they? You know, are we closer to a university breaching its financial covenants with the OFS, or breaching its banking covenants, or getting into a position where it, you know, literally or figuratively has to close the gates and lock them? Yes, I think we are very close to that, and I suspect we've never been closer. Is the OFS /DfE/government going to actually let a major university? I still think that is quite unlikely, with a possible exception of London. I still think that is unlikely because, as you say, that not just the economic ripple effect, but the political ripple effect would be catastrophic. So I do think we are in a world where, and I've written about this, and we're doing some work thinking about this, as I know are others, but we are in a world where there is going to need to be a slightly more proactive approach to regulation, a slightly more proactive approach to financial control. You know, the OFS talks about that in the report they've just released today, and you know, it reminded me quite a lot of the banking regulators sort of post 2008 financial crash, that actually one of the easiest things you can do, or that's not easy for providers, one of the easiest things you can do as a regulator is you increase your liquidity requirements. So banks were forced to hold more capital. You could imagine a world in which, even though they haven't got any, universities are required to hold more capital to reduce that risk. The OFS talk about, again, right at the end of their brief, they talk about protecting students, as indeed to the Office of Independent Adjudicator, who released their report this week as well. So there are lots and lots of discussions now starting to happen about the types of preemptive action which we will need to take if and when something more significantly serious does happen.
Looking at some of the data coming out, DK has done a chart on net liquidity days. So that seems to me a classic one of those sorts of measures that you're talking about, Jonathan, because, you know, you could say, well, and we'll put the chart in the show notes, but you could say, well, you need a certain amount of days liquidity to be financially viable. Otherwise, we're not happy with that. And, you know, there's already an extremely long tail of providers that have shockingly
exactly, and this is both the strength and the weakness of the sector. So it's heterogeneity, particularly on financial issues, you know, and you can see that when you plot them on the tableau, you can see that there is, exactly as you say, a very, very long tail of providers who have a very, very small amount of liquidity. And if you click on any of the other sort of options of the tableau, for depending on how you want to look at debt service ratio or look at pension liabilities, again, you just have a huge spread between some universities that are relatively well capitalized and relatively well protected, and a much larger number of which who are you know, sort of tailing down towards the right hand side. So this does represent an issue, because sometimes what happens at Whitehall level is you look at averages. So again, you see that in the OFS brief. They look at the average amount of income by universities. They look at the average amount of reserves held. They look at the average amount of liquidity. And that's where you tend to get the conclusions that although there are pressure, the university sector as a whole is financially sound. But what that masks, of course, is a large number of people who are well below that average.
Yeah, that's right. So particularly when you map those providers below the average on a kind of geographic basis, you start to see all sorts of kind of major areas that are going to run into trouble. So you could cut it in so many smarter ways. I mean, Eve, as you know, as we've got you, let's talk about kind of the quality implications of this, because, you know, if the sector is going to climb its way out of this financial hole as is hoped and predicted, then we are talking about a significant retraction. We're talking about major cuts. We're talking about cutting services because expenditure has to come out of the system somehow. And clearly that leads us to, you know, a question about, you know, how the sector maintains its, you know, how its quality. I mean, like, we could argue about different definitions of quality or whatever, but broadly,
yeah, completely. Interestingly, I think it was the Financial Times pulled this out in some of their reporting of this yesterday, that OFS expressed concern about the impact of some of these cost-saving exercises on student choice by region, subject area, or particular types of students. And I think that raises the question, to speak to Jonathan's point, about sort of what would more proactive sort of regulation or action in this space look like. You know, how do we prevent there being sort of cold spots, either by region or in subject area? You know, particularly by subject area, this will be music to the union's ears that OFS have picked this up, because if it's the same sorts of courses, but sort of driven by the same kind of calculations and metrics that are being cut back or cut completely, then over time, that has a really, really severe impact on student choice and, you know, the sort of ability for the UKHE sector to you know, offer such a broad range of high quality stuff. But the reality is that good quality education and good quality courses cost money. And I think it's sort of short-sighted policymaking, though obviously it's being driven more by ideology, from policymakers who have been banging on and on over the last 12 months about high quality education and high value education, I suppose is the other phrase, that you cannot simultaneously care about students accessing high quality education, if you're also making policy decisions that directly hinders the ability of providers to deliver that high quality education. QAA published a briefing paper actually on this about 6 weeks ago, maybe, just really drawing that link explicitly between the funding of the sector and the quality of the sector, and that if there is no action taken to provide that kind of long-term financial sustainability, then we will see quality start to decline.
Yeah, yeah. If you're looking at this, Jonathan, from a Labour point of view, so an enormous amount of work going into Labour's preparing for government. We're starting to see now a bit more meat on the bones in terms of the commitments and the overall approach. If you're looking at this coming in, what's the you know you're not going to be able to provide a silver bullet. You know you're not going to be able to do anything extremely particularly unpalatable, like raise fees, particularly ahead of a general election, almost certainly not after it either. But also you're desperate not to see universities fall into the sea, because that is going to undermine the economic foundations of the entire country, which are shaky at best. And you need and you're going to need that to do all the other good things you want to do, right? So kind of how would you square this circle?
So you cross your fingers and hope that nothing happens pre-election. Then you get into office. I think the thought process goes like this. You think, number one, let's reverse some of the hostile rhetoric on international students, which is free, and hope that partially reverses or totally reverses some of the declines we're seeing. That is the single most important thing that the government can do in the short term to try and increase the financial stability of the sector. And they're, I think, pretty clear that they will try and do that. Let's see how successful it is, but I think they will do that. I think the other thing that Labour will probably try and do is they will try and bring universities more into the civic and place-based architecture of government. And I think if you look slightly more creatively at research funds, at whatever is going to be called levelling up funds that are not levelling up funds anymore, if you look at the various different things that might be open to mayors in terms of local taxation, I suspect they will at least try and find some way that some of that will flow through to the higher education sector. Obviously, the research funding already does. But I think in the short term, that is essentially what you try and do to buy the sector sufficient time to make the cost savings, which they are already making, which will not be easy, but I think are going to be a necessary part of the story. And that, I think, essentially gets you through to kind of year two or year three. And then we'll see after that.
We'll see. Yeah. Just on that year two or three, because I mean, clearly, it's not that far away, and people are already talking about this and thinking about this, but can you imagine a more interventionist kind of policy regime to try and deal with these problems? Because clearly you can sort of get to safety in year one and two, but then there's a quite a big job to do, isn't there, in terms of putting the sector onto long-term sustainable financial footing, and also then you'd expect the government to try and want to align it better to its own priorities, wouldn't you? So I'm sort of more of a comment than a question, but I can sort of imagine, stronger market-led interventions, the sort that give, people on the right
conniptions, yeah,
bleeds like student number controls, but also, potentially even further, if we're depending on how bad things have got, tariff points and other things.
Yeah, I mean, look, I can imagine it. I mean, I think it's a sort of interesting, if slightly bleak, thought experiment as to what a Conservative government would do, who believes in market power more. And as I say, outside of possibly London, I don't think that they would let a university close. I think it is absolutely impossible to imagine a Labour government, even with a stonking great majority, to let a university in a provincial town or city close its doors or even retrench significantly. And so I do think that some of the things, like, as you say, student number controls or various other elements absolutely could come back into play if that was felt a way of keeping the sector more sustainable. Well, no, I think it's the opposite. I think if you were being completely brutal about this, you may look at the number of students in London and the number of providers in London and say that London is, quote unquote, overserved. So in exactly the same way as if you look at what the FE sector did, the FE commissioner appointed out of Whitehall essentially went around the country with a team, looked at in every single area supply and demand and said, there's a bit of over demand here. You need to sort yourselves out. I don't think Labour would be that explicit with universities, but you could well say if a smaller institution in London looked like it was going to fall over or be merged, you would perhaps be more content by that.
I think there's two things on that. So in the IFS briefing, what really concerns them is, in quotes, a disorderly market exit. Mm. And if you have to tolerate that some form of market exit could happen, you need to find a better regime than the one we have now that will protect student quality, student outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. I think on your question mark, in the long run, the options are that either you continue to hope that universities can make sufficient savings to continue to operate as they are, you allow universities to embrace more market types of working that can be about immigration reform, visas, fees, etc. Or you need greater state intervention, either in direct funding or the way that policy allows universities to access other funds. Short of that, without a clear strategy that looks at one of or a mix of those options, you basically accept permanent decline, which I can't see a Labour government doing either should they be elected.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Eve, Jonathan, James and Michael who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.